The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got a slew of questions lined up. I know Jim has a Social Security question to begin with, which we'll start there as we normally do. We'll dive right into it today because we have kind of a tight schedule today. So this will be on the shorter side as far as our podcast goes, probably 45 minutes or so. But Jim, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. And you have a juicy Social Security question for us.
I don't know how juicy it is, but yes, I do have a Social Security question.
Perfect.
Excellent. All right. Since we are short on time, I will forego any highs to people and just jump right into the question. This comes from a fellow Coloradoan, if you will. Mm-hmm. Says, hi, Jim and Chris, and Bob, too, even though Bob's not on today's show. Mm-hmm. It is a Social Security question. We always try to lead with Social Security questions. It came in, by the way, on July 24th. Do you know the significance of July 24th?
I'm sure there were some people born that day, but...
Yeah, some very famous people born that day.
Really?
Exactly. Yes. Cool people are born that day. People with a mastery of the English language are generally born on July 24th.
You don't say.
It's my birthday, folks.
You're calling that out. That was a month and a half ago.
And I still haven't got my gift from you.
We were given gifts now?
I thought we were. I was actually in Kentucky on my birthday, so you're excused.
That's true. That was your gift.
Anyways, came in on my birthday, and he continues, I really enjoy your show. I get so much value enjoyment out of it. Keep up the great work. I am a fellow resident of Colorado, high in the West Elk Mountains at 8,885 feet. He is up there. I was at 7,800 feet. Mm-hmm. That's where you are when you're up there. Red Feather is about 83, so he's even higher than some parts of Crystal.
Yep.
But... So that's way up there. He's not doing much gardening up there, I'll tell you that. But then he wants us to guess the town. I'm going to have to go with Montrose because that's the only other thing that are out near the West Elk Mountains. But I have no idea. Could be Crested Butte.
I don't think Montrose is that high. So if you have to pick between those two, I'd say Crested Butte.
All right, listener, we're guessing Crested Butte. Let us know if we're right. Okay, he continues. Sadly, my wife passed away this year shortly after turning 57. So we do want to pass our condolences on to this listener for the loss of his wife. But he continues, I'm 55 and will turn 56 later this year. My wife and I had always planned on delaying my Social Security until 70 as I'm the higher wage earner. Mm-hmm. My PIA is $2,900 a month. Mm-hmm. My full retirement age is 67. Mm-hmm. I retired at age 50 and my earnings record is static. I have not had any earned income in the past 5 years. My deceased wife's PIA is $2,000 a month. Her full retirement age is also 67. Mm-hmm. According to her Social Security statement, her survivor benefit for her spouse, meaning me, will be $2,275 a month if benefits start at full retirement age. My question is, whose full retirement age are they referring to when survivor benefits are concerned? That's his first question. Then he has a second question. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take the first one first?
Yeah. So survivor benefits, excuse me, are really affected by a couple of items. It starts with how much the decedent, in this case his wife, their benefit would have been or is currently if they are currently collecting. That's the kind of the starting figure, if you will. Now, she was young enough that she hadn't actually started collecting yet. So the second test, as far as what determines the actual amount of the survivor benefit, is when the surviving spouse claims, how old are they? So there's two things that can affect it. I'm going to ignore the case where she claimed early because she never reached the age where she could have claimed at 62. So it's really going to be based on her PIA. So it's all going to flow into his age when he claims the survivor benefit. So he could claim a survivor benefit as early as age 60, assuming he's not disabled. I didn't pick that up. If you're disabled, you could claim it as early as 50. But he can claim her survivor benefit as early as age 60 and take a reduced amount because he would be claiming it below his full retirement age, which is 67. So he'll pay a penalty, if you will. But the unique thing, and that might be where his second question is going to lead, is that if he claims that survivor benefit, he can claim it alone and then later on switch to what he was originally going to do, maybe age 70 claiming, where his benefit will be as large as possible, 24% bigger than that 2,900 figure that he told me or told us in the email. So it's at this point, the only thing that's going to affect the size of the benefit is his age when he claims it. If he were going to permanently claim it, like he had a really small benefit that would never be bigger than hers, which is not the case, but if that were true, he might decide, you know, on delaying all the way up to his full retirement age. There'd be no reason to delay past that because he cannot himself, as the survivor, generate additional delayed retirement credits. But he might consider claiming it 65, 66, 67, if that was going to be ultimately his biggest benefit for life. In his case, his benefit is larger. So this is leading me to believe that he's going to be wanting to entertain the idea of claiming hers alone first, even though it's at a reduced amount. And then at some point, as late as age 70, switching to his benefit, getting the benefit, kind of, we call it being paid to wait. He's going to collect a benefit while he's waiting on his benefit to become as large as his age 70 benefit if he waits that long. So at this point, it's all up to his age when he claims. You have to unmute yourself.
Yeah, you hit me out of the blue on that unmute. I thought you were going on.
Why good?
I didn't realize you were going to stop that abruptly.
Well, I'd want to get to the second part of his question.
Okay. Second question. Mm-hmm. If I claim survivor benefits on my spouse's record, mm-hmm. do my benefits continue to grow until age 70? And will I be allowed to switch to my own record at that time, thus maximizing my benefit amount? If so, it appears that the optimal strategy would be for me to claim the survivor benefit as early as 60 to maximize the lifetime payout across both records.
He's right on track. Everything he's told me leads me to believe that that is the most attractive strategy as well. So for those of you who have lost a spouse, the tragedy of that, it does open the door to this type of claiming strategy where you can kind of jump back and forth between them. They're independent benefits where you can claim one and then switch to the other later on. The other key to remember is, I didn't mention it because he's already stopped working. If he were working, that might be a reason why he wouldn't want to claim the survivor benefit as early as 60, because the survivor benefits are also subject to the earnings test. For him, that's not really an issue, though, because unless he's planning to go back to work. So I did want to mention that for those of you who are still working, who might be in a similar circumstance, that might not be as clean of a strategy. But given his facts, I think he's right on track claiming his own at 60. I'm sorry, claiming the survivorship at 60 and then collecting that all the while waiting until he turns 70 and then switching to his own. That will likely be overall the best strategy for him.
Okay, one other thing he wrote that I think I will continue for you. He says, P.S. Chris, my daughter will be taking your Introduction to Financial Planning class at CSU this upcoming semester. I think I am more excited about that than she is.
I'm sure that's probably true. Well, wow. Well, that's cool. I'm not sure I've ever had a podcast listener's child in class, but I will make sure to embarrass her in some way. I'll do it kindly, though. I'll be gentle. So we'll see. That's kind of cool. I'll have to check around and see what's up with that.
I will give you his name so okay. You can see.
So I can track her down.
So you can track her down. I mean, because you don't know. How many kids are in that class of yours?
About 30. So not a lot. So she's going to be okay. Easy to find.
Okay. Well, that takes care of his question. Mm-hmm. Oh, is there anything else you want to add to it?
No, I think he kind of was already on the right track of where he's going on this. So I agree with his final conclusion that claiming the survivor and then switching seems to make the most sense in his case.
All right. So we've got another question here, a very short question from an Ohioan. So he gave us his real name. We're going to call him George, as we always do. And he says, greetings from Ohio, Jim and Chris. Thanks for all the helpful information and for keeping the show entertaining. Can you describe how you would build a portfolio for a new retiree and what asset classes you have them invest in? Fairly straightforward question, listeners. And I could take this answer, Chris, and do a four-hour show on it, or I could do a four-minute answer. I'll lean towards the four-minute answer, okay. Not the four-hour show. We don't have the time. A lot could be, listener, said into this to describe a lot of what we do. You don't give me, though, enough information of the new retiree. Is it a new retiree who has to immediately begin taking distributions from their assets to live on? Is it a new retiree who has substantial income from secure sources? Is there a spouse that is working, even though this retiree isn't? We often look when we design portfolios for people, especially distribution portfolios. And that's the key that he's talking about, Chris. I'm sure you picked up on it. And I want all listeners to pick up on it. He's asking, how do you design a portfolio and what asset classes do you do for a retiree? Let's change the word retiree, Chris, to a distribution portfolio, from an accumulation portfolio to a distribution portfolio. Let's assume he's saying, hey, when I start taking money out of my portfolio, how do you design that portfolio and what asset classes do you use? That's how I want to view this, as opposed to using the verbiage retiree. Because if you use the same investment management strategy that you use to accumulate wealth, to decumulate wealth, you will get into trouble because of sequential risk, which is sometimes referred to as reverse dollar cost averaging. What do we mean by that, Chris?
Well, in a distribution phase portfolio, you are susceptible to the worst timing of returns, in that bad return performance, specifically negative returns early, are far more harmful when you're distributing than negative returns that happen somewhere in the lifespan of an accumulation phase. In the accumulation phase, you're just waiting. You're leaving those assets in there, maybe even contributing more, waiting for positive returns to overcome the negative returns that you experienced. When you're decumulating or distributing, which is what most people are doing in retirement, although some retirees have enough secure income that they're not immediately distributing, so that's a kind of a different case. But if you're distributing, when there's bad returns early on, that's the worst possible time because your account balance is largest, so the dollar value of the drop is highest given a certain percentage loss in the portfolio, and you are making it permanent by being forced to distribute those assets while they're in the depressed value state. That's probably the cleanest way I can describe the harm that early bad return performance in your portfolio can cause you if you're susceptible to that. And there's different ways that people can go about mitigating or protecting themselves from this particular kind of risk. But that's the essence of sequence of returns risk, or like you mentioned, some people call it reverse dollar cost averaging. Not only is it reverse, but it's harmful dollar cost averaging.
So what we generally do, listener and listeners, when we start approaching a distribution portfolio, and we've talked about it, we've done shows on it before, we start to do what we call positioning. We used to call it bucketing. We don't anymore for a variety of reasons. But what we start to do is try to match the assets of the client to the spending that those assets are going to be used for. And we're not going to get deep into it on this answer. But what we start to do is obviously money that's going to be spent right away, perhaps to cover minimum dignity floor shortages, or in our opinion, fund spending during the go-go phase of your life. You've retired. You don't know how much longer you're going to live. None of us do. You want to do things when you can. Chris and I believe passionately that once we can help people determine out of their wealth how much of their wealth can be spent on fun, that's our whole process. We're not going to bore you with that in this answer. But once we know how much of your wealth you can spend on fun, we do encourage clients to spend a lot of that fun number, as we call it, during your go-go phase, that period of early retirement when you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to do fun things. Money that's going to be spent on fun should be kept, for the most part, safe. If you have a go-go period that could be 8, 10, 12 years, perhaps money that is realistically going to be spent 8 years from now, 10 years from now, can be invested. But even fun money, folks, that is going to be spent over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, Chris and I believe should be kept very safe. So what I'm going to encourage you, listener who asked this question, to do, start thinking through the eyes of a distribution portfolio. Don't have one portfolio anymore. You're not going to have one big 60-40, 70-30, 80-20 portfolio. Start breaking your money into smaller slices. Start investing each portion of your money appropriately from a risk and return standpoint from the spending task that that money has been assigned. Again, in other words, if it's going to be spent relatively soon, keep it safe. You're looking at return of your money, not return on your money. And then monies that are going to be spent later in life, or at least right now have been earmarked for later in life, you can invest much more aggressively. But then he asked Chris, what asset classes do you use? Now, what we do works for us and our clients. It doesn't necessarily work for everybody. For asset classes, I'm assuming you're talking very broad categories. We consider asset classes to be cash, stocks, and by stocks we mean U.S. stocks and foreign stocks, fixed income, which can be a very broad asset class with many different types of fixed income, and then generally commodities and real estate. Those are the main asset class, with commodities and real estate taking a very small slice of our client portfolios. We model our portfolios, as we said repeatedly, against Morningstar target risk portfolios. I won't get into how we do that. But listener, don't just concentrate on asset classes. Don't ignore sectors and styles as well. I separate them out. Some people don't. But what I mean by sectors, you could have certain sectors of the market. You can have consumer cyclicals, you can have healthcare, you can have technology. Those are sectors of the economy or the markets, if you will. But then you have different styles as well. You can have growth, you can have value, you can have blended. So you have styles, you have sectors, you have broad asset classes. We generally have about 20 different exchange-traded funds in our client portfolios that run the gamut across those assets, sectors, and styles. So that's about as deep as I want to get into the answer, Chris.
I think, is there's not one answer. Just because you're retiring doesn't make you like everyone else and would need the same kind of approach in this regard. We talk all the time, and Jim mentioned it as well, but I'll repeat it kind of condensed, that you know what to do with your money once you've assigned it a job, and you know when the job needs to happen, and you know how big the job is, if you will. So jobs are things like funding fund spendings, funding minimum dignity floor, setting aside for potential long-term care needs, a guaranteed inheritance. You know, go down your list of all the things, all the jobs you want to accomplish or be prepared to accomplish, because some of the jobs might not show up. So it's you're preparing just in case, like long-term care may or may not show up. For those of you who choose to be prepared if it does show up, you're going to have a portion of your financial resources dedicated to doing that. And once you've assigned all these jobs and you have an idea of when they might occur, it's that information that will help guide you as to what's the best approach for dealing with your money. And that's when you then bring in, okay, you know, makes sense to combine these, this, that, and the other thing to accomplish this job 20 years from now. You know, this, that, and the other thing is best if I got a job that is needing to happen in 2 years. That's the kind of an idea here that we're trying to relay to you.
Exactly. Okay. Another quick question here. This one is from a Californian. I'm not sure. I'm not going to be able to answer the exact question they're asking. And I think you would agree it's beyond our scope on this show. But I think I can give her a little bit of information so she kind of has some things to think of. So it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I have a question regarding selling an inherited property or if I should rent it out. If the step up in basis at death remains intact and doesn't go away, do you think it would be better to sell and pay zero capital gains or keep a home as rental property? The home I'm talking about is worth $1.2 million and has no mortgage. The basis is $980,000. Monthly cost to maintain the home, including taxes and HOA fees, is $1,600 a month, but the rental income is $5,000 a month. Would it be better to sell the home and invest the proceeds or continue to rent it? The property is located in Southern California."
Those are kind of two different questions, first of all.
Yes. We can't really tell her, sell it or continue renting it. I think that is a question that is going to have to be based on her needs, what she wants to do. I just want to explain how the law works. You said the basis of the home is $980,000 and it's worth $1.2 million right now. So it's got about $220,000 or so of gain in the home. I don't know much about the home. If it's yours and you may be dying, or it's someone else's and you may be inheriting it, but with the numbers you gave us, if you did inherit it tomorrow and the basis is $980,000 and you turn around and sell it and it, the person dies and it's worth $1.2 million on the date of death, that $220,000 of gain will be wiped out because of the step-up in basis rule. So you could theoretically sell it right away for $1.2 million and owe no taxes. Mm-hmm. However, keep in mind a few things, listener. Even if you held it and it grew mm-hmm. to $1.5 million, your new basis becomes the 1.2.
Right.
You don't have to sell it right away to be able to use it. That's locked in for you. Right. So even if you continued to rent it, I mean, you gave some pretty good numbers of you said she only mentioned the HOA fee. So I'm guessing there's no mortgage on the property. I don't know.
No, she said all the expenses were about $1,600 a month.
The HOA fees is 16 monthly. Oh, that's right. Monthly must to contain and HOA fees is $1,600. So if you're paying $1,600, but you're getting $5,000, it's a good trade-off. I'm assuming the house is in good condition. It's in Southern California. It may continue to appreciate.
Or not.
So maybe, or not. Right. But maybe you would want to hold it. I can't possibly begin to tell you to hold or sell. I just want her to know, Chris, she's never going to lose that $1.2 million of step-up in basis.
Right.
That's going to be locked in. Whether you sell the house right away or sell it later, you're going to lock your basis in from the 980 to the 1.2 million. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think those are two separate issues because, as you pointed out, whether she sells it or holds it, the step up occurs. So she doesn't have to sell it in order to get the step up. But if she worded it in a way, it almost sounded like she thought she needed to. Holding it then becomes the question. Do you prefer to sell it and do something else with the money, or do you want to remain a landlord? And she doesn't give us any sense for how attractive that situation is for her. So that's where she'd have to start doing some discovery and decide, are the potential benefits of the situation of being a landlord, do they outweigh the pain or the annoyance and the trouble and risk involved in being a landlord? And if she prefers something else, then that would tend to lead me to believe she should, you know, sell it and move into that something else. If she does full discovery and has due diligence and fully understands what she's doing and decides, oh, this landlord gig looks pretty good and it fits my overall situation and my retirement plans, I'm comfortable with that, then she could, you know, she could certainly do that. I think it's worth entertaining before you jump to a conclusion of sell or keep. You really need to look into it, discover what else you might do with it and decide which you prefer. That's really what, you know, investing is all about, is deciding what fits best for your situation, what you're comfortable with. Always keeping in mind, we prefer in retirement specifically, not so much when you're 35 or 40 and you can handle a lot of things going on, but as you move through retirement, we prefer simplicity. So the one thing I would say is make sure that the landlord rental situation financially still makes sense over the long term, even if you include the cost of professional management. If you don't actually do the day-to-day dealings on this, in case you, even if you're all for it now, don't assume you're going to want to continue doing that 5, 10, 15 years from now, and make sure that financially it still makes sense if you're paying a professional manager to deal with all the headaches for you. That's the one thing I would say when you're considering it.
Exactly. And also, listen, you don't give us any information on your overall wealth, all the other assets you have.
Right.
Will all your assets and wealth be tied up in this property, even though it's generating some good cash flow? It is illiquid. Or do you have a lot of other assets? Mm-hmm. And if you do, are those other assets invested, like we just answered for the other gentleman, in more traditional asset classes, cash, stocks, U.S. stocks, foreign stocks, fixed income? Well, real estate might be a good diversifier perhaps for you. So there's a lot of other things she has to, or he has to, look at as mm-hmm. well.
Right.
Okay. This one is probably more up your realm. I have some ideas for it, but he's got a question on figuring out a potential crossover point on his funding of his minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. And he wants to know if you have any insight for him.
Okay.
says, hello, Jim and Chris, and your whole financial planning team. That's the first time someone's given a shout out to everyone. You have a very educational, entertaining podcast. My name is, and we'll call him George, and I live in North Dakota. So here's the best time of year is fast approaching for North Dakota.
Fall or?
Winter. I'm being facetious.
Oh, that best time of year. Are you testing that up for retirement too?
No, I won't go to North Dakota. We have clients who moved to South Dakota a little while ago. And when I talk to them in the winter, it's like 20 below in South Dakota. So I can only imagine what North Dakota is like.
It's for hardy folks.
Yeah, it's not for me. I want a garden. I don't want to deep freeze. Like, my middle name isn't Birdseye. So, no, I don't want to go to North Dakota. Okay, my question is figuring out my minimum dignityful crossover point. Mm-hmm. I'm 61 and retired military. I'm going to delay my Social Security until 70. And with my military pension, I feel my minimum dignity floor will be covered. However, my Social Security statement says in 2035, only 79% of promised benefits are going to be paid to me. Before you answer that, Chris, let me continue going on. Mm-hmm. And to make matters worse, I was born in 1960, which I understand may cause yet another reduction in my Social Security benefits. So if both those cuts happen, I think I might be short on my minimum dignity floor in my late 80s. So my thoughts are to maybe buy something now, maybe I-bonds or TIPS or something else to cover the future shortfall if those two Social Security reductions happen. I do have long-term care insurance based on a typical five-year or less insurable event, but I was wondering if you could share any insights into my minimum dignity floor problem. Any insights would be appreciated. Thank you, George.
Okay. Let's do the back half of it first, because that's really his question. I'll leave his other comments and maybe make a short comment myself. Those could be discussion items in and of themselves for an extended period. But the essence of his question is, he is worried that he will have a shortage of secure income to cover his minimum dignity floor showing up, based on his projections, somewhere in his mid to late 80s. He's currently 61. The way we would recommend people deal with that, so that they, you know, feel better about being protected against that possibility, is to, as the younger retiree, take some of your assets, set them aside, so that if the 85-year-old needs some additional secure income, if these issues he mentioned or anything else causes a shortage, where it doesn't even matter what the reason is, no matter what the reason is, if you're worried about having a shortage later on, setting aside some of your liquid assets to bolster your secure income at the time, I think is important. Buying something specific that's income related isn't the way we recommend you do it, because again, we don't know if the shortage is going to show up or not. He just wants to have the peace of mind of knowing he's prepared if it does show up. Now, he mentioned a couple of specific places to, quote, invest the money over that period. I would point out that he's talking about over 20 years from now, this happening. That's a long enough time horizon that I would not approach, at least initially, placing the reserve or buffer to the side in something that is what, like he mentioned, necessarily, because I don't think it's going to keep up as well over the long haul with inflation, and will cause you to have to set aside more. Now, maybe he's flush with assets and it's not really a big deal, and he likes the peace of mind of having it in something very, very safe, but I don't know that you'd have to do it that way. There, we'd have to know a lot more about all the rest of his situation to say that, but I did want to point out that I would tend to think that with a 20-plus year time horizon, that at this point he could take a bit more risk than he was talking about, but he wouldn't have to if he had enough to set aside today. So it's not, everybody's unique, right? Everybody's can decide where they fall on that spectrum. That's how we would handle it and then monitor the situation and see how things evolve. And sometime maybe in your early 80s, if you're getting confirmation through the data that you're looking at through that time period and the projections still look up to be on track of having a shortage, start to consider late 70s, early 80s, maybe formally putting in place a plan for additional secure income. I'm only saying that because I don't think it's practical for someone to wait until they're 88 or 89 to finally take a look and decide what they're going to do for secure income. I think that's just not a great time, a great age to be diving into this. I think there should be some planning and a decision made a little bit before that. A decision doesn't need to be made at 61. That's too early. 88 or 89, I think that's too late. I think it needs to be a little bit earlier than that. But the 61-year-old will have put together or put aside some money so that the 78-year-old or 80-year-old or 81-year-old will definitely have it there in order to deploy some type of enhancement to the secure income if they decide. And it doesn't even need to be necessarily at that time. Secure income, honestly, depends on a lot of variables, like the degree of the shortage. Maybe it's quite small in the estimates at that time. Maybe there's longevity really isn't an issue. It's almost, if you're in a situation where you can't imagine living another year or two, then income doesn't make sense. If you have tons of other assets where there's really no chance that you're going to run out at that point and you're way past your go-go period of fund spending, that's already water under the bridge and you're still sitting on a ton of assets, this becomes an academic exercise. The fact that you set a little money at 61 doesn't really matter at that point. So a lot of stuff can change, a lot of monitoring to be done. That's the way I would look at it.
I would say I like everything you said, and I do want to drive home again. He mentioned I bonds and TIPS. Mm-hmm. I will agree. He never told us how much assets he has, if he's a very conservative investor and he doesn't want to take on any risk at all. Right. My concern would be his minimum dignity floor is going to be increasing at rates of inflation far higher than the I bonds and TIPS will be protecting his dollars with their inflation adjustment. It's going to be tied to general CPI, whereas his minimum dignity floor, right. If you look at the elements of a minimum dignity, at least the way Chris and I do it, listeners, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, those expenses tend to go up at rates of inflation far higher than general CPI. His TIPS and I bonds will be tied more towards general CPI. So I don't think that they would be able to keep pace. I got the impression he was trying to figure out, hey, I'm going to need X amount of dollars, $300,000 when I'm 85 or 88. Why don't I put that aside now? And if I put it in TIPS and I bonds, it'll keep pace with inflation. If it's tied to your minimum dignity floor, I think that inflationary rate might be higher. But I also agree with you. You got to look, and it kind of ties into two questions ago. How do you invest for a retiree? And I said it has to do with positioning. This is money, Chris, that he's lining up to be spent a very long time from now, by his own admission, his 80s. And I believe he says his late 80s.
Right.
So it could be 85 plus, and he's only, I think he said he was 61. So it could be 20, 24, 25 years from now. From a risk capacity standpoint, one could be fairly aggressive if you don't need the money for 20, 25 years. Risk capacity is different than risk tolerance, folks. Risk capacity, Chris and I pay attention to a lot, but it pretty much relates to, in simple terms, when is the money going to be needed? Long time from now, high risk capacity. Short term from now, low risk capacity. So from a risk capacity standpoint, Chris, he could be more growth orientated. Perhaps from a risk tolerance standpoint, right, which is your emotional reaction to risk, perhaps from that standpoint, he can't handle that. That would be something different. But I am saying, listen, from a risk capacity standpoint, you might be able to reserve less money than you were going to if you were only going to put it in I bonds and TIPS. And I think you use a 3% discount rate, Chris, when you project a future minimum dignity full shortage. So we don't discount it by a huge amount, a very achievable 3%, correct?
Generally. Depends a little bit on timing and what their other situation is. But yeah, we definitely use a conservative approach to what type of assumed rate of return this reserve might experience as you're saving for it for a potential future need of covering minimum dignity floor.
But I would try to manage anything earmarked for a minimum dignity floor shortage in the future to at least keep pace with minimum dignity floor inflationary pressures, which tend to be higher because of the expenses that they cover. That would be my warning to him or to anyone who's trying to do this on their own. And also recognize, listener and listeners, this has to be viewed every single year throughout the year, in our opinion, but it needs to be monitored. It's not a set it and forget it, one and done. So you may come up with in 2021 what you think your future shortage is. Keep monitoring it, because maybe by 2025 or 28 or 32, it's changed. It could be substantially higher and you need to put more money in. And that may mean having to take from other future spending needs. Or, Chris, it may be higher than you need. And perhaps it's going to allow you to take some money that was earmarked for minimum dignity floor later in your life and perhaps enjoy it on some fun spending at the current phase in your life. So you always need to look at these reserves. That's the whole idea of positioning, is to line the money up. But you have to look at those positions. You have to look at the performance of each of those little micro portfolios, if you will. You have to continue to project your spending, your shortages, your income, the COLA adjustments he may or may not have gotten on his Social Security and military, compare it to his personal minimum dignity floor ongoing, and there may be changes that he's going to need to do. I just don't feel I bonds and TIPS are, I don't want to say they're not appropriate, they are, but I think you could perhaps reserve a little less and try for a little greater return, even if it's a moderately conservative style portfolio. You might want to look at something like that. Mm-hmm. But that was the thing that I wanted to point out. And I'm sure you're going to now just kind of explain to him a little bit about what that 79% payout, and is he being a little
well, I want to point out something
unrealistic.
Real
and the
quick,
age 1960.
Yeah, thing. let me point out something right before that, though, because I think people might have a takeaway that you didn't intend for something that you said. There's no need to invest the buffer with the goal of having a return that will keep pace with the growth of the minimum dignity floor. Those are two completely separate things. What the return on the buffer is going to determine, your assumed return on the buffer is going to determine how much you need to set aside. The safer you intend to treat that buffer, the more of your money up front you're going to have to put in. The goal is to have a certain amount you estimate you need at 85, 88, etc. How you get there can be high returns with a little set aside early, low returns with a higher amount set aside. But you don't have to actually, you know, because the minimum dignity floor might very well be growing at 4.5%, 5%, 6% even maybe for certain people. And you don't have to, I think what you said might have implied to people that they needed to invest the buffer to earn at least 4.5%, 5%, 6%. Don't have
no,
to do that
at all.
No,
we use a 3% discount.
Yeah,
rate.
But you then said something else that implied that.
Oh.
So I just wanted to make sure that was clear to people. The second thing on his issues that he pointed out about, you know, in the 2033, 2034 timeframe, maybe only paying out 79%, that's assuming Congress does nothing about the Social Security system. The trust fund will be exhausted approximately that time. They're estimating it all the time when it'll run out. That doesn't mean there's no money to go around. It just means that Social Security can only pay out what they collect, and the math tells them that they would only afford to be able to pay out about 78, 79% of their current promised benefits. Do I think that's going to happen? No, because the closer we get to that point, the political pressure will be so tremendous on those that control this that I can't imagine a scenario where they just let everyone suddenly take a 21, 22% cut in their Social Security. So I think that's unlikely, particularly for someone who's 60 years old. If you were 30 years old, I would say, I don't know what the changes might be to your benefit calculation, but assume there will be some. 60-year-old, I think you're too close. I think they're going to protect you in whatever they do. Secondly, and we've talked about this before, so I'll just briefly mention it, those born in 1960, a year ago, due to the COVID pandemic and the effect on the wages earned in our economy, the worry was the wage inflation, which does play a part in determining your Social Security benefit, was going to be particularly harmful for those born in the year of 1960. That fear has really faded off into the background now. The last estimate I saw, and things have only gotten better as far as news goes since then, the last estimate I saw a few months ago is that that big cut that they were expecting that was maybe noticeable, 3.5-4%, that it might affect 0.5% your benefit itself. So there might be a little ding to it. But I would suspect by the time this all plays out that you're not going to notice any particular negative effect on your benefits simply by being born in 1960. So the final records will come out over the coming 6 months or so. We'll have clarity on this and I'll revisit the topic. But right now, all indications are is that initial fear was overblown and that there really isn't, of all the things to worry about, this should be well down on your list, in my opinion.
And I just want to finish then with one other thing to every listener, not just this listener, because a lot is coming to mind, especially on the way we do things. He's rightfully concerned that the older him may not have enough secure income. Mm-hmm. Maybe his reasoning is a little bit off the thought that the government will let people receive 79% now and not 100% of what they were, or this 1960 fear that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Maybe those won't materialize, Chris, but other things could.
Yep.
So it is not wrong for him to want to reserve money later for the older him, even though right now his Social Security and military pension is taking care of the younger him. So we often will, and Chris does it with all the software that we use and his own knowledge and expertise, but he'll come up and let people know if he feels they should, even though the numbers look good, we can see that sometimes, Chris, the numbers are real close. And if things don't quite go as planned, you might need some money. We give people the option. We can monitor it for you every year as you keep working with us. Or you might want to put a little bit of money aside, and Chris will give them an idea of about how much they might want to consider putting aside. What do we mean by putting aside? It's still inside your IRA or your brokerage account or your Roth or all three. It's still there. You don't have to take it and literally put it in a separate account. It's just off limits in your positioning. As you start slicing up your big cherry pie of retirement wealth, you're going to put a little bit of slice. You're going to say, this money is earmarked for my 80s. I'm in my 60s. I have a 20-year risk capacity, so I can be fairly aggressive with this investing. Now I'm going to match it to my risk tolerance. Well, gee, I don't want more than a moderate amount of risk. I tend to panic. So you may then go and invest it moderately and earmark it towards a future need. The idea is to understand you can only spend a dollar once. You can't spend it in your 60s and spend it again in your 80s. So if you feel there could be a shortage, you put the money aside, and there's nothing wrong with that. We encourage it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of Chris's calculation, before we give the final fund number, and it's final only until something in life causes it to change, but when we give you that number that you can spend on fun and not feel like you're robbing the older you, that's the whole concept behind our quote-unquote fun number. Out of your, let's say you had $3 million saved for retirement, how much of that can you spend on fun safely and confidently without putting the older you at risk? After you go through our whole process to determine that, Chris asks one more time about yet another buffer, not just a minimum dignity floor buffer, a general buffer, folks, for any unforeseen circumstance that may come up. And we encourage people to put even a little bit more aside. So do recognize that built into our process, we are always encouraging people to build buffers, we call them, but put other dollars aside because you never know what will happen. Your Social Security may not be cut, listener, and your being born at the age 60 issue, rather, may not be an issue for him. Being born at in 1960, not age 60, may not be an issue, but another issue may come up that could tax your minimum dignity floor. If you're worried about it, put some money aside.
Yep. Perfect. Well, that'll have to wrap it up for today. So we want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to send in your own questions for the Q&A show, just go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can also send Jim an email directly, jim@jimhelps.com. And Jim, you have a nice weekend, and we'll be back with everybody else next week.
All righty. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.